Mr. Chairman, my name is Rear Admiral Tim Sullivan. I'm from the United States Coast Guard. I'm the commander of the 1st Coast Guard District. And I thank both you and the council for your time this afternoon. Actually, as most good sailors know, is I'm just reporting back as ordered or as promised. I had promised you essentially a year ago, came before you to review a couple searches for two lost vessels, and I my intention today is to get back to you as the chairman and to the board to let you know to the rest of the council as to how those investigations went. Just as an aside, and I know Captain McGinnis mentioned it this morning, is we were trying to keep Georgia's Bank clear this morning. We've had, and I'm going to have to excuse myself shortly after my presentation, we have a LNG tanker that was trying to go aground off about 35 miles off the coast, and we've got two tugs on it. I know, as Joe mentioned, it's one of them. We have a proud father on one of the tug one of the tug mates on today that has done a really good job. There's now four tugs. She's making good about three knots in a positive direction away from the shoals, so that's very good news for all of us. Next slide, please, EJ, if you got a... I need to explain again, I wanted to get back to you from the Lady Grace and Lady Luck sinkings from last year. I want to let folks know right up front is I have no disrespect at all by blacking out certain photos or names. The regulations that my bosses govern me by and these investigations require that personal information on persons still missing be protected, even if it's available through other sources. So I won't apologize for that. It's just our rules. Nor do any of my comments today, Mr. Chairman, in any way intend to show any disrespect for any of the proud sailors that we've lost, those missing, or their families ashore. We have personally briefed the families involved well before we released the reports or any reports that went to the media. So I understand that. We're certainly within the course of a tough week last year as we lost six fishermen. What I know all of you understand is a very preventable potential tragedy, which I'll try to give you a little bit of background on this afternoon. Six men, as far as I'm concerned, pay with their lives for mistakes that were made and risks that were perhaps not as well understood as they should have been. Six very good men from what all the reading and background I could do, trying to make a living for themselves like many of you have continue to do and certainly provide for their families. So to continue to endure these sort of loss of lives, at least in what we do for a living in our fishing communities, certainly without learning from these deaths and the ultimately not taking action to prevent similar losses would really only compound these tragedies, and that's one of the reasons I'm here today. So as I think it's very important that we do look into these matters thoroughly. I will, as I always have, is speak very truthfully of these tragedies and improve our ways in dealing with a tragedy like this just so they won't be repeated. I believe this is probably the best way to honor these brave fishermen and their families. Probably would want us to do is to be full and fair. I realize that as long as folks go to sea, there have been tragedies at sea, and unfortunately they're likely to happen. Perhaps it's a part of the risks, the putting of oneself to a certain extent against nature. People, I know in this room, it's a certain enamorment to some extent that many of us have had, and as you all well know, as I do, it can often be a very unforgiving environment. So certainly part of what probably I went to sea for back 35, 40 years ago, and maybe part of what my son is doing out at sea. So while I certainly fully appreciate the risks that these and many of us put our lives on at sea, tracks of maybe a certain attraction of living on the edge, if you will, I also hope that both we, the Coast Guard, we in a broader sense will continue to apply the knowledge and technologies to make progress to hopefully reduce and I'll dare say eliminate the risks in doing so. Mr. Chairman, I would ask, and before I go too much farther on into this presentation, I'd ask for the continued support which you have provided and that of the council. Most importantly, I think, the continued support of fishermen towards the pursuit of commercial fishing, an industry that would hopefully make them free of death, free of injury, if at all possible, where we can continue to provide a culture of safety and responsibility, hopefully would overcome what can often be construed as a needless loss of life. Next slide, please. Let's talk about just for a second the Lady Luck. We lost the Lady Luck and her crew on January 31st of 2007, just over a year ago. She left Portland, Maine, and subsequently sank about 30 or so miles southeast of Cape Elizabeth in about 70 fathoms of water. There were no witnesses to this tragedy. There was no distress call. The EPIRB functioned properly, and a search was immediately commenced. The EPIRB was recovered with a switch in the automatic position, and for those that don't know, it means it wasn't manually activated. That certainly was the first clue to us that whatever happened to Lady Luck may have been both very rapid and obviously very catastrophic. Otherwise, we would have to presume that the crew would have made a distress call and hopefully manually activated their EPIRB. So without witnesses and with the vessel resting in more than 400 feet of water, our investigators certainly had their challenges. The investigation focused on the design and history of the vessel. Our Marine Safety Center has actually built a model of the vessel with all its current modifications and conducted what we consider to be a very thorough technical analysis. This investigation is unusual in that we also benefited from a technology when a company volunteered along with a variety of Coast Guard assistants to demonstrate their capabilities of its underwater remotely operated vehicles and assisted us in ascertaining the condition of the vessel and exactly where it laid. This capability, I would repeat, is not normally available to the Coast Guard, and we were very pleased in this particular case to have it for this investigation. Just in this picture, and I'll try to point it out with this handy-dandy laser thing, is one of the things I'd like to point out to you, especially, I think, for fishermen. If you notice right there and then just to the right, those freeing ports that would were closed, and they would normally they limit the ability of the deck to drain water. And again, this is going to become a little bit more important as I continue this presentation. I'm going to try to show you a, if our technology works here, is a short example of a video that the ROV was able to get for us. This is Lady Luck 70 fathoms down. This 30-second clip is actually part of more than 2 hours of video we have. The clip is of pretty poor quality compared to the original, and I'd like you to know that the original was examined and enhanced for us by the National Transportation Safety Board, the same folks who look at jet airliner crashes and so forth. This is an example of our thoroughness and just one of the factors that caused these marine investigations to take so much time. You may recall that some persons felt that there was this was likely a collision-type scenario. The entire two-hour video, and again, you're seeing just a clip, shows the boat intact without damage and shows no evidence of a strike by another vessel. We also visited every ship known to be anywhere near Lady Luck that night, and none, by the way, were very closer. But we visited them at their next port of call. We saw no evidence of a strike on any of those vessels, and so we certainly can't, I'd be lying to you that I cannot absolutely rule out a strike, but again, there's no witnesses, and yes, in fact, some parts of the hull were not visible to the ROV. You might be able to pick up some of that. We're confident that no shipping was near her. We found her resting in a remarkably intact condition, and I would consider it to be a ship strike highly unlikely. Well, so if it wasn't a ship strike, then what's our guess? What's what likely happened? Next slide. Thank you. As I said earlier, our Marine Safety Center performed a very thorough technical analysis of this vessel. Its characteristics were, quite frankly, not good. She was, as many of us would use the term in stability concerns, a tender boat. That is, in some conditions, it would take surprisingly very little force to capsize Lady Luck. If you put a little bit of flooding, perhaps unknown to the crew, or seaboarding aft, in some be enough to capsize her. We thought perhaps the engine room had flooded, but eventually determined that this was not a very likely cause. Our Marine Safety Center analysis noted that the flooding of the engine would have caused a slow degradation of stability. Hopefully alarms would have sounded. Crew would have hopefully had time to react, but there was no distress call, as I mentioned, no manual activation of the EPIRB. So in our estimation, it was not likely that the engine room flooded. So based on the Marine Safety Center's modeling of the vessel, we learned the vessel became unstable with just a few inches of water on deck, and it became highly unstable with about 50% flooding of the Lazarette. Ultimately, we determined that the most likely cause of the tragedy was a rapid capsizing event caused by a combination of both water on deck and likely Lazarette flooding. The elements for this scenario are all present. First, modeling shows the vessel's course and sea conditions at night would have facilitated shipping water over stern or quarters. That alone is enough to have capsized this particular vessel. Second, the freeing ports, as I showed you before, originally designed to let water on deck overboard, at least some of them had been obstructed. This means, of course, that a water from a wave was spending a little bit more time on deck. You get free surface effect, as many of you know. Third, the recent survey history of this vessel showed a pattern of problems with the Lazarette being non-watertight, both from underneath, that is, rudder packing leakage, and possibly from above, as it had been noted that her hatch cover was corroded and potentially was non-watertight. Ultimately, the most likely scenario for a rapid capsizing event on Lady Luck was that water, likely put on deck by sea conditions, lingering on the deck due to those obstructed freeing ports, some fluttering in the Lazarette. That would have quickly made her very unstable, and as far as we're concerned, she likely capsized very rapidly. We'll honestly never know with certainty, and we can only deal with likely and unlikely scenarios. Next slide, please. When she sank, many of us, myself included, where the heck's the life raft? Well, again, we were glad to have the ROV, and we wanted to make sure that these safety systems, of course, that you all know better than we do, that we require on fishing vessels work. The next clip partially addresses the life raft issues, and the clip starts at the hull of the vessel and traces a straight line. That is the sea painter, or the line, of course, that comes, you can see it right along the ocean floor from the raft. That's the line that we're looking at, sea painter from that raft. Remember, this line is straight, and that's going to be an important clue here in just a second. And there's the raft when you're going to get to the end of this line. These conditions indicate that the raft inflated likely fought the Lady Luck all the way to the bottom, where the external pressure of the sea eventually compressed the line, compressed the air out of the raft's buoyant chambers, and of course it sank. But life rafts are supposed to automatically, of course, separate themselves from the vessels, as you all know. And why didn't this one do that? Well, we're very frustrated that we don't have that answer. Perhaps the painter was caught up on the rigging. Perhaps it was improperly installed. Perhaps a hydrostatic release and a weak link failed. I just don't know is the honest answer. I do know that our boarding officers sometimes find rafts improperly installed, although we know... We don't know that that is the cause in this particular case. We certainly, from the Coast Guard, have redoubled our efforts, Mr. Chairman, to both train our boarding officers to thoroughly examine the installations of these life rafts and other life-saving devices and help our fishermen ensure that the gear is properly installed. Next slide, please. So what lessons can the loss of these two lives teach us? Well, perhaps regrettably, they don't teach us as much new things as we'd like, sir. They do, however, highlight the price that might be paid when prudence, at least in my estimation, does not get enough attention. First of all, obviously, is for any fisherman to maintain good watertight integrity. We'd all be saddened by the learn of Lady Luck's wet Lazarette, but we also know that she's not the only one that has wet Lazarettes. Many of the hulls plying New England waters are not getting, as from what we've seen on our boardings, probably not getting the maintenance that the sea demands. 12 hulls have sunk in the last 3 months alone. Most of those at the dock, fortunately, but a number at sea. That's a pretty big number, at least to me. maintaining your vessel's ability to drain that shipped water that we talked about before. Freeing ports are often viewed, I know, for many fishermen as a nuisance because they allow some minimal water on deck during even lighter weather. But those who close them off, choose to close them off, which is certainly possible, are in fact potentially causing themselves problems down the line. By closing those ports, of course, you sacrifice heavy weather survivability for comfort in lighter weather, and we're obviously recommending that folks just don't do that. Stability, of course, is the other big factor here. Again, I want to stress there was no regulatory requirement for this vessel to have a stability assessment because of its length. But masters, owners, and engineers need to know and understand the stability characteristics of their vessel and how fish, ice, fuel, freshwater, bottom hangups, material conditions, weather anomalies can affect that particular stability. A stability assessment is just the starting point of a professional maritime operations. The knowledge from the assessment needs obviously to be put in safe practices. So a model of the Lady Luck, in fact, that was created, failed 5 of the 7 stability criteria currently applied to boats greater than 79 feet. 5 of 7. You have to pass all 7 to get a letter. Had a stability assessment been performed, perhaps, and I say perhaps, the owner or master would have known about the potentially very tender condition of this vessel and perhaps would have taken action to correct the situation. Stability assessments are not currently required by regulations for boat less than 80 feet, but stability assessments and safe operating practices derived from stability assessments, as far as I'm concerned, are very much still needed. They are really the foundation of a safe operation for commercial vessels. So I think the couple lessons learned here is check your life saving gear often, make sure and ensure that your life rafts are properly attached and can float free, and that you know what your stability assessment of your particular vessel is. Like one tragedy is not enough for today, I'm going to give you some info on a second one. So next slide, please. This is the Lady of Grace. Different case, obviously, altogether. Lady of Grace was lost on January 26, 2007, while transiting Nantucket Sound, coming home from Georgia's Bank to New Bedford, Massachusetts. 4 men lost their lives on this vessel. There was, again, no distress call. There was no EPIRB hit. There was no life raft found during the search. She was, by all accounts that we can figure out from our investigation, a well-maintained, well-operated vessel. Her captain and crew were experienced, in some cases, lifelong fishermen. The vessel, though not required by the Coast Guard, had completed limited stability assessments, thought necessary by both, obviously, her captain and insurance underwriters. The Lady Grace was eventually raised shallower depth and scrapped. No hull damage was noted. Collision scenarios, again, very unlikely. The Marine Casualty Investigation examined many scenarios, but quickly centered on icing and a subsequent capsizing is the most likely cause. Communication that night between the vessel and her shore management indicated the crew was concerned about the ice they were taking on. The National Weather Service had forecasted severe icing conditions. Hindcasting showed the Lady of Grace to be in the potentially worst place at the worst times during the ice weather event, so the conditions were, from our estimations, as predicted. Similar vessels on a similar route at nearly the same time experienced near catastrophic icing conditions themselves, and icing would have caused a sudden capsizing consistent with no distress call, no donning of survival suits, no abandonment of the ship. Next slide, please. Again, we put our Marine Safety Center to work. They conduct an extensive modeling on the Lady of Grace, and she actually fared pretty well. In fact, she would have survived more than 12 times the icing loads normally considered in stability assessments. So she could have taken more than 2 inches of ice everywhere. That's more than 40 tons and still have survived. Then came the conditions on October 26. Bitter cold, brisk breeze from the northwest. Sounds pretty familiar to me. In these near-perfect ice conditions, given the vessel's course and speed and the ice accretion, far exceeded her 40-ton margin of error. Soon, so much weight from the ice accumulated above the waterline that she could no longer keep herself upright. She capsized and sunk. And we see again that fishing vessels, even those with stability that's known, must continually be operated with due regard for nature's ability to even overwhelm whatever man can bring at him. So did the stability testing in this particular case work, Mr. Chairman? I guess the honest answer is we'll never know. It did not prevent the sinking, and it won't certainly bring back these proud fishermen. But as with Lady Luck, it's not the stability test that really counts, but rather the knowledge of safe operating practices and limits derived from stability assessments that really can make a difference. Had the crew possibly fully understood their icing limits and the margins of safety that they had or didn't have in this particular case, they might have been gauging how much ice they were rapidly accreting on that vessel. And they had worked those scenarios maybe out ahead of time, understood that the imminent danger of the situation, perhaps, again, they could have taken different actions. So what can we take away from the loss of this vessel? Next slide, please. Well, even before she sank, it's likely our particular Lady of Grace example here was in trouble from ice. Typically, of course, winches seize up, foredeck gear is frozen in place and out of use. Crew would have probably been tired, quite frankly, from not only fishing but ice removal efforts. Visibility is limited. Port can't sound. Radar antenna could potentially be frozen. Safety gear is impaired. No condition that I know is improved by ice. And the fishing vessel in this photo made New Bedford soon after Lady of Grace would have. You can see, obviously, substantial ice, and you see that if Lady of Grace could withstand 2 inches of ice, that the conditions she encountered were capable of obviously making a lot more. Note the orientation of this vessel, and this is not a crooked picture, by the way. It's moored aft. You can see the pilot house windows are level. And you can see a list of starboard that had developed, and this is on the Iberia II. We'll never know how close we came to losing the Iberia II, but that vessel was very near catastrophe, too, and they, as far as I can see, were just plain lucky. And playing to be lucky, my experience, is not a good way to sail. Ice removal is really hard, slow business. I've done it myself. It's fatiguing, very dangerous work, and at times the sea can put it on faster than you can take it off. Next slide, please. So, therefore, of course, the best strategy is to avoid icing altogether if you can. Obviously, stay in port until the weather improves. If you're at sea, stay in the warmer water. If you cannot avoid icing altogether, act with exceptional caution. If you have to come in, remember that the bays and sounds provide often a false sense of security. Usually, of course, these are colder waters. Spray created as a boat transits warmer ocean swells is replaced with a fine mist of bay and sound waves. The mist super cools, and the freeze freezes onto the steel, and the rate of icing can, and often does, in fact, increase as you get closer to land, not decrease, which some of us might think as we get closer to the warmer land. Certainly consider laying over in the first safe port of call rather than maybe proceeding to your home port. Consider taking a longer way home, even if it's through warmer water. Start talking to us. Start talking to your owners as to, hey, we're building up ice. We're having problems. This was probably less than a 30-minute total launch time and on scene from our air station where this particular vessel went down. We had no knowledge that she had any problem. You can run down swell. You can minimize that, again, that relative wind and spray. And obviously do all you can do to remove ice as quickly as you can, especially ice that's high up. Obviously that becomes a stability problem. The higher the ice, of course, the greater the danger. Next slide, please. This is a good question. What has the Coast Guard done since we've lost these men? Coast Guard has worked to provide more specialized training to our boarding officers, as I mentioned before, in our New England Regional Fisheries Training Center. We're lucky to have the CO here with us this afternoon. We have and will continue to raise boarding officer awareness of life raft attachment issues relative to weak links, hydrostatic releases, and common problems with installations. So we may help fishermen ensure that their survival gear on their particular boat is certainly never compromised. We have added an icing module to the voluntary fishing vessel safety training that we conduct in partnership with industry and the fishermen's advocacy groups. We continue to pursue stability regulations for vessels less than 79 feet. And I must say that the efforts of this council or the efforts of the Coast Guard that I've served in, while important, is certainly not paramount here. What matters the most and always has, and probably likely always will, is that decisions are made by those particular owners, those particular fishing vessels, relative to their own safety. That master of that vessel, that captain, has got to be the one that knows that vessel, knows what's safe or not safe in that particular vessel better than any one of us here. Ashore, of course, we have highway safety institutes put out guidelines and government set regulations such as speed limits and police patrol on roads and so forth. And still, we all intuitively know that the driver is probably the most important person as far as his or her own safety. All of us can relate to that. I don't think it's any different at sea. Fishermen, especially masters, owners, engineers, make decisions that knowingly or otherwise have a great impact on their own safety and, of course, the efforts of many of those that try to help them. So what can owners and masters really do to set themselves up for safe fishing? Next slide, please. I should obviously also be very mindful to sea, and I realize to many of you I'm preaching to the choir here, and I apologize for that. But especially in a storm, that mindfulness really is obviously most important. Sea demands, again, that material condition, especially watertight integrity and safeties, have to be maintained. We see time and time again the price for imprudent maintenance, and again, it's altogether way too high, as all of us know. That gamble of delayed maintenance given time is what I would consider to be a guaranteed loser. No man certainly should be able to gamble with the lives of his crew. In the last 3 months, for instance, as I mentioned, we've had 12 vessels sink within the First Coast Guard District, my area of operations, two at sea, and the 10 of them at their moorings. Material condition, in a lot of cases, really has to be maintained. Conducting those stability assessments and determining safe operating limits. Take that knowledge from the stability assessment to set those safe operating limits. It's a maximum safe weather and maximum safe icing. Use the knowledge gained in the assessments to set safe operating practices, such as what your water and fuel minimums must be, fish and ice management, the holds. Again, all good practices that the masters have got to be held responsible for. Once you set safe voyage plans and those safe operating practices, you got to stick to them. Avoid conditions that exceed those safe limits. We're all pressed and pressured to do different. Once, probably the last but not least, is to plan out those emergency responses. Rodney and I were talking at the break on that. Knowing what your approaching safe limits are, act decisively to carry out your predetermined plans and correct the problems before they emerge. Planning is best done ashore, that training that many of you are involved in before that vessel scene. Train crews to recognize and react to emergency situations. It's going to be a tough situation out there, and you're going to have to, if you don't have the training, you're just automatically not doing it, you're going to be in trouble. There's often, obviously, especially in these cases, very little time for anybody to react, especially that of an untrained crew. The master could get hurt or be a casualty himself, and anyway, some chips are going to be down, and the rest of that crew has got to know what to do, and the only way to do that is continual training. Next slide, please. Mr. Chairman, for quite some time, more than 15 years, the Coast Guard has been trying to get stability regulations in place to help fishermen understand and account for stability in the operations of the vessels. We have not been successful, in part due to at least some industry opposition, and in all fairness, it's a very difficult effort. Some of our proposals have generated controversial, but we're going to continue to push those through. Government, industry, and fishermen should resolve the impasse over stability issues such that every fishing vessel master will know the safe operating limits for his vessel, know when he's standing in the stability danger, know how to act decisively to correct stability problems, bring every boat and every crew home safely. I don't think that's too much to ask. Whether or not stability regulations for smaller vessels get passed, responsible owners and operators should know their conditions and their limits now, regardless. I know the council has always been a very staunch advocate for intelligent safety improvements to the industry. I pledge you my help in pushing the stability agenda forward, and I ask, Mr. Chairman, for your continued support and that of the council towards finding stability solutions that keep all our fishermen safe. For our fishermen, again, I ask, I said I fully appreciate the risks of life at sea and the attractions of sometimes maybe living on that edge. I also hope that as we progress, we can, as I mentioned before, both either reduce or hopefully even eliminate these tragedies. Again, for members of the council, I ask for your continued support and dialogue. I ask for your continued commitment to a commercial fishing vessel that's free of death, even free of injury, where you, as many of you have, has continued to push for a culture of safety and responsibility that can overcome, I think, what is often a needlessly fatalist acceptance of risk and tragic outcomes of some very stalwart people continue to make their living at the sea. Final slide, please, Mr. Chairman. Again, I want to sincerely thank you and the council for your time this afternoon. I know you have a very busy agenda. In closing, again, I'd like to say that my presentation is in no way are any of my words meant to embarrass or impugn those deceased, missing, or left behind and their families. It's meant instead to speak quite frankly of these tragedies, present lessons learned, and yet again in the hopes from all of us to avoid death, operate safely, and avoid any future tragedies. I'd be pleased, as you see fit, Mr. Chairman, to take any questions regarding these investigations. I realize that these are often sensitive and passionate matters, so I'd also offer I'll be remain here through the next break if anyone has a question that they prefer to ask in private. I also have a couple subject matter experts with me here today that have an in-depth knowledge, and of course you all know Captain Joe McGinnis, and he'll be here through the rest of the day to ensure that if you do have any questions at any regard regarding my presentation at all, I'd be happy to do that. So, sir, I again thank you for your time, and if you've got any questions as you see fit, sir, I'd be happy to try to answer this.
Thank you very much, Admiral. Any questions for the Admiral? Rodney.
Yeah, thank you very much, Admiral. For the last 7 months, I've been doing safety inspections and safety drills on these vessels, and I've noticed some of the same problems that you've identified today. But one of the biggest problems I notify is the weak link is not weak enough. It takes over 500 pounds to break that link. If a life raft is not fully inflated and the pressure going down, it's not 500 pounds. So I don't know if there's anything you could do or somebody could do to minimize that, make that maybe around 300 pounds or something like that.
Mr. Vila, that's great feedback. We'll take a round turn on that. I'll work with both the board here as well as our experts, if you will, to take a look at that. It's a great point. I'm certainly not a physicist, didn't even stay out of Holiday Inn last night, but that makes good sense to me that you'd want to keep some sort of balance there between the amount of pressure that you don't want to just pulling off and at the same time enough that that would release a lot quicker. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on what Rodney said because we don't – all we have is the manufacturer's word that these weak links are weak enough. I mean, I don't know if mine is. I don't have any way to test it. So I was wondering if you were going to go around and maybe test all these manufacturers' weak links and make sure that they are, in fact, weak enough. I mean, I'm very concerned now that that thing might not break when it needs to. I'd rather have it be too weak than not weak enough.
Sure. Again, I certainly won't pretend to have the answer for you as you don't either, Dave. But let us take a round turn on that and see what a practical application might be out there. Most of the cases, of course, as you know, with any kind of manufacturer type piece on a safety equipment, you do have to count to a large extent. I know in part of our testing of that equipment along with the manufacturers, which, of course, as you're well aware of, we both write regulations for often and then enforce, is a part of that testing that we do initially on a new product or a rewrite of a product is, in fact, to do both the theoretical and the actual pull and so forth on those tests. I have no reason to believe that they are not meeting those regulations from the tests that we've done, the feedback by GIT. But, again, your and Mr. Vila's points are well taken, and I will make sure that we take a round turn on that, sir.
Jim Allen.
Yes. I read a Coast Guard report back a couple of years ago, and something jumped out at me right away is that most of your casualties were on vessels that are around 28 years old. And I bet that most of the 12 hulls you have had happen in the last few weeks, are most of them are more than 28 years old. And point I'm trying to get is I think the majority of the fleet is getting past its useful life. And the reason that we're having this issue is that the industry is stressed and nobody can replace a vessel with a new vessel. So if we could get to a stage where people could start building new vessels, they would come under some of the new requirements that you put in effect as far as construction stability. And I don't know, do you have a comment on the age and useful life type of thing?
I don't have certainly information on the particular vessels that have been lost at sea. I'm not sure I'd be willing to take your bet, but I don't think it's too far wrong. I think that's probably pretty accurate that most of those vessels are older. As far as the what it takes from the fleet side of it to look at the large economic expectations and I'll call it a kind of a break even point. Again, I'm certainly not a businessman. Where at some point the amount of product that you're bringing in allows you at some point to obviously remanufacture, if you will, to either improve or buy new. It makes good sense to me. It's a concern to the Coast Guard. We work very closely, of course, with the chairman and the council, as well as NOAA and many others, to again provide that good honest feedback. We do track the age of the vessels overall in our boardings. I think your assessment is generally accurate as to our impact on that. You probably wouldn't want me to look too much closer at a 28-year-old boat than you would at a brand new one. It does make a certain amount of common sense to us as a boarding officer and in my particular case looking at supervisory levels is to look more closely. We've got some recent cases where we've got some real old vessels that we are, quite frankly, looking at a lot closer. Thank you, though.
Anything further? Okay, Admiral, thank you very much for taking time out to come and present to us directly and personally. And as always, we look forward to the input from the Coast Guard and working together with the Guard as we develop our management plans. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, you're welcome. And again, thank you all to the Council for your time this afternoon.
Okay. We are on the open period for public comment. Anyone that in the audience that wishes to bring an issue to the council that's not on the agenda for discussion at this three-day meeting, this is your time to do it. Is there anyone in the audience? There's a few. Okay. Gentleman with the hat.